Hey, good afternoon, everyone. It is Thursday, 1 p.m., and that means it's time for Family Business Radio on Business Radio X. Just to remind everyone, as we do each week through Family Business Radio, we are showcasing family businesses and building a community designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. So each week, our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. I'm Pat Rombaletti with Sage Executive Search, and I am one of the hosts. My other host is Meredith Moore.
Hi, I'm Meredith Moore with Moore & Associates Wealth Management. It's good to see you this week, Pat.
Yeah, good to see you too. Good to be back on the show, and we have another great one. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. You know, a few weeks ago, Ray Pagano and Gary Anderson told a really interesting story about, with a very happy ending, to Ray's exit strategy for his family business. But we well know that this is not always the case, especially not in this economy. But sometimes the picture really isn't as bleak as what you might imagine. Our guest today is going to share his experience as we discuss how to take control of your exit, all from the perspective of a business valuation expert.
Yeah, and we're very happy to welcome you. Mark Damon, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, Mark, we always like to have our guests tell a little bit about their background because you can hit the highlights better than we ever could. So can you tell us a little bit about all of these credentials that I see after your name?
Yeah, sometimes they get pretty heavy after a while. My background really is in business consulting, but over the years I've spent a lot of time in the appraisal side and also moving into litigation support and transactional work. So those are the three business lines that we have, and that has led frequently. I've always been involved in the value enhancement side of businesses, which got me into exit strategy over the years.
Oh, we're going to delve deeply into that. Can you tell us a little bit about your company, CapVal and American Business Appraisers?
It's a national appraisal litigation support company. We have about 25 offices nationwide, and we focus, because of the broad number of people, quite a broad skill base in appraisal work, and like myself, a lot of people do litigation support and are involved in exit strategy, and some get involved in transactions.
Mm-hmm. And then do you have another division? Is it the McLean Group?
The McLean Group is our investment bank. Mm-hmm. That main office is in Washington, D.C., and it, again, has a number of 20-some-odd offices nationwide.
Excellent. Well, you know, Meredith mentioned our April 22nd show and about a guest that sold his business successfully back in 2009. You mentioned exit strategy, and not everybody has such a perfect picture success story these days. You know, a lot of businesses are in tough places. Seems like that anyways. I mean, what's it like out there?
No matter what the economy is like, you still have people wanting to get in and get out of business. And actually, there are two dynamics. One is that there's an unbelievable amount of cash on the street. And because of that, there are many buyers for businesses. The bigger question is, are businesses in a position to be sold? And many are. Sometimes they have to be sold for a whole host of reasons. So there still is an interaction going on one way or the other. And that's what makes this time kind of exciting, is that there actually are a lot of buyers if there are sellers that are ready to make a transaction occur.
Got it. I guess we're going to talk a little bit today more about being in control of the sale, not being
right.
Having to sell. So,
right.
Great.
Makes a big difference.
Absolutely.
So talk to me a little bit about what kind of transactions are you seeing right now?
Well, they go across the board. There are a lot of transactions involving distress. And candidly, of that money that's on the street to buy, a lot of them are after the low-hanging fruit. You're never going to be able to get around that, especially at a time like this. It's a natural time for buyers to try to find deals. Mm. But the reality is there are a lot of good companies that have positioned themselves well for a sale, and a lot of interesting prices are being developed, like that case you had a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the multiples that were there were quite spectacular, but that took a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time coming and a long time planning, and that really is what makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
You need to find a way to make yourself more important than simply the pure dollars in your own pocket. There has to be a compelling reason for somebody to buy you.
Are those shoppers looking in any particular industry segment?
It's across the board, even in bricks and mortar type businesses, manufacturing, by the way, and distribution and warehousing. We tend to see a lot in government contractors.
Mm.
Our president is the largest buyer of products in the world. So the government contracting business is a very hot place to be. And if it's combined with technology or logistics, or energy,
mm-hmm.
it becomes even more compelling.
Hmm. Interesting.
Now, the U.S. government, I don't think people focus on this too much, but the United States government is the biggest single customer in the world.
Yeah,
and they buy a lot of private services.
And I guess with those guarantees that a business might have in terms of a contract, that would help build the value of that business up simply because of the stability, so to speak, of the U.S. government as a client?
Always does. Always does. Always does. And it isn't just the $50 billion company. In fact, the federal government has a program where it requires smaller companies to be government contractors.
So in essence, if somebody could get that government contract, that's going to do nothing but enhance the value of that business.
Absolutely. As long as it's a good or service that has shelf life.
Hmm. Well, I guess that's a big part of the topic. What really does drive value and price?
You know, there are really three characteristics that I'd like to talk about. One of them is something that we call value world, and that isn't my term, by the way. That was really developed by another individual, but I like using it because it makes a lot of sense. We can talk about that in a minute more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other things are come down to very guttural issues at each company. One is the ability to produce income. If the company is not producing income, it has limited value. I mean, it's basic fact of life. And the third element in there is risk. The more risk that a buyer perceives in your business, the less value it's going to carry, regardless of the cash flow that's coming through.
Hmm. So go on and talk about value worlds. I was pretty fascinated by that in our earlier conversations.
You know, value worlds really relate to who's going to buy your company. One of the first things you need to think about, and by the way, you should be thinking about this several years before you want to get out of your business, is who exactly is going to buy it from you. And start to develop a plan around that. And depending upon who you want to sell that business to, you will actually earn a different amount of proceeds for a whole host of reasons. Some of it's legal and some of it's just practical finance. For example, if you want to transition something among family, you're stuck with what they refer to as fair market value. Fair market value is a hypothetical buyer and seller, both relatively knowledgeable of the facts and circumstances. And it is really one of the lowest standards of value, as it's referred to. A standard of value is one of the lowest. So when you make gifts, people who gift securities or sell to family members need to follow fair market value. It's, relatively speaking, if what you want to do is transfer within a family, that's actually a very good thing because the price is low.
Right.
Let me throw it way on the other side of the scale a second, and that's the strategic transaction. And that's the one that you had a couple of weeks ago, that fellow a couple of weeks ago, sold it to somebody who recognized, and I'm going to overly simplify this, that it's cheaper to buy that business than to try to build that marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
That's a strategic transaction. And buyers are willing to pay far more for something that has strategic implications to it or synergistic implications to it than they are just simply transferring it among a family. And there are other value worlds as well. One of the others is selling it to John Doe on the street. A financial transaction. Again, that's more than fair market value, less than strategic, but it's often the sale that takes place many times between businesses. Just a new buyer on the street. A lot of times they're trying to buy a job, but they usually pay more than fair market value, but they won't pay strategic value.
So when you have a case, I mean, you look at how you want to value the case, be it if it is within a family with fair market value or if it's a strategic acquisition. So your methodology is going to be vastly different than a family. Is that correct?
Absolutely. If you're going to transfer within a family, you've got a whole set of problems you need to deal with that are different than trying to sell it to Acme Pharmaceuticals, who you're hoping to get an unbelievable price for it. Those are two different markets to go after. On the family side, you usually are very tax-motivated in structuring the deal, and one of the biggest problems you have is trying to find a family member who's capable of taking over the business. That is not an easy thing to achieve.
I also know, at least I know in my practice, when we're looking at gifting stock and so forth, we're looking at strategies on with minority shares, basically, to reduce value in what that is. So, I mean, is that a reduction of value off that fair market value number, or can you speak to that?
Well, actually, it's a component of fair market value. It's a piece of what fair market value is to that piece of stock or equity, whatever it was that was being given away. Yeah, actually, we're in a a time when you can take discounts for lack of marketability and lack of control. Those discounts, by the way, there's debate going on in Washington about whether they're going to allow those to continue. It's one of the reasons why now is a great time to be giving family assets. If you're going to make a gift, you're probably, this is the best time probably to make that gift today.
Is it prudent to, with your evaluator, with your CPA, to come up with a very tangible list of reasons why that stock could be discounted if you got audited, or what are the pitfalls potentially of gifting stock to a son or daughter at a discounted rate?
Well, let's be honest here. In order to make any gift like that, you need to have an appraisal done, and it has to be an appraisal that stands up, and it would consider all of the factors that go into the question of discounts for control and lack of control and lack of marketability, and actually this lack of liquidity actually is a bigger issue today than marketability. All of those issues are components of the appraisal process. So when we talk about fair market value of a 10% interest, that already took into account all of the discounts that might have been allowed in that particular case.
Mark, I know with my clients we see all the time, and if I could get a hard and fast rule from you, how often and what should trigger a family business to do a valuation? Some people say every year. Some clients want some event to occur, i.e. they're doing some estate planning. I mean, what should trigger doing a valuation?
Well, obviously, estate planning and gifting is a piece of it. Anytime you're going to be giving away a piece of a business, the IRS requires that you have a third-party appraiser establish what the value of that element that's being given, what that element is worth. Businesses, even if they aren't planning to gift it, but they want to sell the business in 5 years, it is a good idea to get at least a thumbnail view of what value ranges are in the interim. We talk about exit strategy, and a lot of people think about selling the business, so they may think about it for years, but suddenly they decide 2 weeks or something before the end of the year, I'm selling it in the next 60 days or something like that. And it's not that that can't be done, but you've given up value. The way to do this really is to think about getting out of it 5 years ahead of time and start planning this. So you need to be able to get thumbnail ideas of value. You don't have to spend a lot of money on it, but you need to get an understanding of what is driving value as early as you possibly can.
And I would guess doing that consistently also makes you prepared if a particularly attractive strategic buyer knocks on your door and wants to close in 60 days, you're prepared.
Certainly farther ahead. And I think people who think about that exit strategy are more likely to start taking proactive steps to get there. And there are a number of real critical issues, I think, that businesses need to do. I was going to say family businesses, but they're even huge privately held businesses have the same issue. There are things that need to be taken care of in order to get to that goalpost.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain, let's say you have a family business, is there a certain amount of sales, so to speak, that justify an annual valuation, especially, again, if there's a clear buy-sell agreement succession plan in place to pass some of the business down to the next generation?
Well, you know, that's a mouthful, actually, that you just threw out there. I mean, you've added the question of buy-sell agreements among family members. Again, there may be a reason to do a value on a regular basis, but there are, if it's going to be a family situation, there are a whole host of issues that need to come into play. Value is only one of those. And like anything else, yes, if you have a buy-sell agreement and it says you need to come up with a value, you should at least have a thumbnail done once in a while to get an idea where you're headed. Keep in mind, at the end of the day, business people don't understand this, I don't think, but they should step back. The real objective was not to take home a salary. The real objective was to build value over a period of years. That really is the objective. So focus on that a minute. What was it going to take to build value in my business over the next 5 years?
We've talked with several attorneys on here about these buy-sell agreements, and sometimes you see a multiple already being put in there of sales, so to speak. Or, I mean, do you have any thoughts about how that value on paper before a sale between two family members would need to occur? Or what are your thoughts on how that language should read?
I'm going to bet that I'm going to give you an answer different than the attorneys did.
Good. That's what we like around here.
Most buy-sell agreements don't work. They don't really consider how to value the company correctly, and they often value it in such a way that people can't execute on them. The reality is that a buy-sell agreement needs to be an understanding among people that a transaction needs to take place under certain circumstances. That's easy to come up with. But it also needs to define what value means. And you can't do it easily from putting a formula in the contract, because I will guarantee you that over a period of 2 months, that formula will come up with multiple answers, which means to me that none of them were right. And if the value had was tied to the date of death of somebody, for example, maybe that person died on the wrong day. You know, so formulas are not a good thing to use in those contracts.
Like the day after they lost the government contract?
Yeah, something like that. That's right. Yeah, that's it. But that's an example of why formulas don't work very well. In my view, the best thing to do is to simply have an appraisal done at the trigger date, whatever date that is that occurs that says a transaction has to occur. And there are ways of actually using more than one appraisal if people don't agree with the results. There are ways of getting around it, but I would just focus attention on when there's a trigger, have an appraisal done.
And you can have language in the agreement to say that?
Oh, absolutely you can. And one of the most important things is you have to define the standard of value in the agreement. Is it fair market value or is it something else? Value world. What value world are these people playing in? Mm-hmm. If you don't say that, you are really creating a nightmare for the parties involved.
Mm. I think that's a great point, Mark, because I can tell you every operations buy sell agreement I've seen, everything is based upon fair market value, and even when there haven't been family members. So this is a very real point that I think a lot of the attorneys don't take into account.
No, they don't. Unfortunately, attorneys don't ask us what the right terminology is to use in this. And fair market value might be the right thing to use, but many times it's not, especially when the transaction probably will not be between family members.
Interesting. So, you know, we talked about strategic and synergistic buyer. They sound like nirvana. Is that the place where everybody should be looking?
You know, here's the point. It depends. Mm-hmm. An owner might want to transfer it to a family member or maybe to his employees, mm-hmm. whether it's through an ESOP or some other mechanism, or transfer it to management. By the way, management is another value world. Mm-hmm. And if I might digress a minute, the joke about selling it to management is that the value of the business is whatever management can afford to pay.
Right.
And I certainly have had cases where a transaction took place with management, and for years that transaction kept being redone until it finally got to the point where management could afford to pay the price, and it was not what we started out with. So you need to understand that you're not always in control when you sell it to employees or management, but many times that's where you want to go. It depends mm-hmm. on what you want to do.
In terms of management doing that, I guess with what they can do, and I have a case right now I'm working on with this, I guess it's going to be up to what the banks are willing to lend him. Is that pretty much the scenario?
You know, that's one of the drivers. It always has been, but today it becomes even more important. And keep in mind for a moment, too, by the way, that the lender may not be a bank. The lender normally is partially the seller in almost every transaction. And there are third-party private lenders out there today. It's the nature of our economy today has created a non-bank lending community. But, yeah, a lot of it is controlled by how much money can be borrowed on the transaction and how much the seller has to take out of it in order to feel like they've done themselves well.
Do you see more, say, promissory notes where the management is paying or the family remaining family member is paying out of sales, or are you seeing like a deferred compensation where the original owner is staying on, and I'm using quotes here, staying on, so to speak, and they're just continuing to get salary?
I do understand what you mean, Meredith, about that. I'll tell you what happens. In most cases, everybody is going to be tax motivated. So regardless of the ultimate purchase price that they agreed to over the table, they are going to try to structure the transaction so that the buyers and the sellers are in the best tax position you can get to. And many times that does mean trying to recast some of the purchase price into a form of compensation. I can't tell you that it always works and there's no fixed rule on it. It's one of these things you don't know what it is, but when you see it, you'll know it. But it normally, that's one of the deal structure issues, is a form of compensation.
So what happens when dad passes business to son, Sun, the sales, and excuse me, they have an agreement set up where it's owner financed, and Sun, the sales end up reducing on the business. And all of a sudden, Sun is trying to service a note that can't be justified for the business. I mean, what do you see in situations like that?
That is an unfortunate situation, and it happens all the time. It's sometimes because the successor is not as skilled as the parents were. Mm-hmm. Sometimes because we walk into a recession like we did 2 years ago, no matter what. What happens is that the child and the parents need to get together and redo the deal. And that's true of management buyouts I was describing a minute, same thing. You get together again and you need to redo the deal, because the only alternative that the father, mother, parent had in this situation was to walk back in, and most don't want to do that. Most parents, I think, do want to have their kids have it if they want to. They don't want to go back in, so they're going to try to restructure the deal as best they can and keep it alive.
So how do you restructure it? Do you go back to Mark Damon to get another valuation, or, I mean, what would that process look like?
Well, you might, but it really comes down to a question of taking a look at what cash flow realistically is going to be and how much a company can afford to pay. I must admit that I don't generally see new valuations being done, because at the end of the day, once the deal has been done, the real question comes down to what is the cash flow available to pay out to a seller, and under what forms. And by the way, you can't be egregious about this. Remember that if a company is worth $10, you need to have a $10 transaction, regardless of what kind of value world you're in. You can't convert selling price into a deductible cost. The IRS frowns on that kind of thing.
Well, it sounds to me, too, if you're selling a business that's pretty cyclical and is going to really have ups and downs, then the payout is a pretty dangerous transaction.
Can be. Mm-hmm. There are ways of getting around it. Some transactions are tied to revenue production.
Got it.
It's especially true for the seller's note, and especially true where there's a lot of strategic value that a buyer is buying and there's a question about whether it's really sustainable, the payout may be tied to production of revenue.
Well, it's kind of like the new college payback standard. You pay X percent of your income after to pay off your loan. So
yes.
It's kind of that.
Yeah, same idea.
Yeah.
Same idea.
And the multiples in a professional service practice as opposed to something that actually has cost of goods or has a physical, tangible product, obviously the multiples are vastly different. Is that the situation?
Well, yeah, they are. You need to be careful with multiples. You're thinking about multiples on revenue.
I am.
At the end of the day, most businesses are bought and sold based on their cash flow, not the top line.
Okay.
And that's the equalizer in this, is regardless of how you got from the top to the bottom, it's the bottom line that's driving value of a business at the
end
of the day.
You mean it's not what you gross, it's what you net?
It's what you take home.
Wow.
Yeah, at the end of the day. That's what the value of the business is. And by the way, it's what you take home after you pay yourself a reasonable salary.
That is a concept.
It is a concept, isn't it? Because otherwise, all you're doing is buying a job.
Mm. You know, I want to go back. Mark, you mentioned something about large business and risk having impact on the price. Can you explain a little bit more about that? I wasn't sure I really understood that.
It's in the formula of values, risk is one of the key determinants. The higher the risk, the lower the value. What we try to get companies to do over a period of time is create transparency. In other words, make companies easily seen. Transparency is such a PC word today, but it happens to work in this case. Make sure that people can see why there's value in the business. And it entails a number of factors that we probably don't even have time to go through all right now, but one of the most important ones that I kind of encourage people to focus on is for owners to make themselves obsolete. If you cannot sell a business easily if that business is dependent upon the owner. It's one of the hardest things for entrepreneurs to work through, and it takes so much time for many people. Some adapt easily to it, but many don't. And they even have trouble hiring that executive team. Or maybe the business is way too small to hire an executive team, but there's still ways of working through that too. But that's probably one of the biggest things, having a business plan in place, cleaning up the business itself in terms of its operations. One of the interesting things that I ran into early in my career was learning that the companies frequently are selling the wrong products at the wrong price to the wrong people.
And there's a formula.
It is, but I had a client. I was not a partner at the time doing this. I was just a staff person doing this study. but analyzing a manufacturer that had a number of different products, trying to see which ones are making money and which aren't. What we discovered is that there was one product they've been making for years that loses money, and the more they make, the more they lose. And if they wanted to improve the bottom line, they could stop making that product. Wow. And yet that is so common in mm-hmm. business today, especially those that have been around for many years, is that they lose track of where they actually make money.
Well, and you mentioned government contract in the beginning. So to me, often looking at a business, risk also comes from having too many eggs in one basket. So on the one hand, having a government contract takes away some risk, but if all of your eggs are in that basket and there's a change of administration, that would be a risk factor, correct?
That is a risk factor, and it's not a distant one either, by the way. That does happen. But one of the things that government contractors do, even if they're subcontractors, by the way, mm-hmm. is develop very good relationships with the payer of that contract, whether it's a prime contractor, whether it's the government agencies themselves. You need to keep in mind that the government is not very skillful in a lot of the things that it needs. I wasn't
You're
trying
kidding.
To joke, make
yeah.
a joke of that, but they really aren't.
It's a shock to our audience.
Yeah, our tax dollars at work. The reality is, though, many of those tax dollars are coming back to Main Street mm-hmm. because they need companies, private companies, to help them run the business affairs, mm-hmm. including defense. The technology is unbelievable, and that's private technology, not government technology. Environmental issues are becoming paramount. Energy issues are. All of those have products, goods and services the government needs to buy. So mm-hmm. there are opportunities. But I have seen situations where they focused on a department that was being phased out. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem.
You know, we're going to talk a little bit further on, I know, about growing a business. But why is a large business simply perceived as less risk?
Well, that's a good point. Large businesses are considered less risky. In fact, I wish you could actually see some of the studies on this and some of the charts on this. The multiples on large businesses are much higher than they are on small. Even with the depressed economy that we're in right now, multiples have dropped across the board, but that rule is still there. And the reason for it is that large businesses are perceived to control the market better. Mm. They are perceived to have second levels of management. That obsolescence feature that I was talking about is usually in place. They have more depth in management as a result of that. Theoretically, the owner could disappear and the company would continue to operate. They have the ability to control production a whole lot more, distribution channels when you're bigger. And I don't mean multi-billion dollar bigger, just larger than a $10 million company is more stable than $1 million company in the very same business because it's bringing all of those attributes to the table. All of those reduce the risk that the buyer will not be able to duplicate or improve on what you did yesterday.
Yet, on the other hand, if I'm a $50 million or $100 million business going up for sale, if I take those attributes and attempt to bring them into my business in the scale that's appropriate for my business, that's going to help me contend better with those business, larger businesses, correct?
Oh, yeah. Always does.
And how do you know?
In theory, that's what every business should be doing. It's just that we don't do it.
How do you know your scale is right or appropriate to where you're scaling it? You're growing efficiently, basically.
Oh, I think that's a question you got to look at in every case. Growth, a lot of people think of growth being top-line issue. The real question is, are we also growing the bottom line at the same time? Mm-hmm. Are we building value as we grow?
Mm-hmm.
If we're not, then the growth may not be there. And I will tell you, in these times, one of the things that many businesses are taking a look at is whether they're actually operating the way they should be mm-hmm. and whether there's a better way to not grow and mm-hmm. still make more money. Or maybe we should become a virtual business.
Mm-hmm.
And simply manage the transaction process and not be in control of it in terms of all of the incremental pieces of it.
Mark, we always recommend that that our listeners turn to trusted advisors, kind of like yourself, for help on issues. And can you give us an idea how you've helped your clients with some of these exit strategies?
Well, there are a number of them. They all come down to... really, a first question is, normally we get involved with an entity because the owners want to know, if we were to sell it today, what's it worth, realistically? And we frequently present it from the position of the lowest value to the highest value. In other words, the lowest value world to the best value world, so that people can see a range depending upon what they want to do with their company. It allows them to focus attention. If they've been thinking about giving it to their kids or selling it to the family, here's what realistically the price is going to be. If you've got strategic advantages and we know that there are buyers out there paying certain amounts for those, this is what it would be on the strategic side. So we can provide them with a range of value. The other thing we normally provide them with is an action plan to enhance that value, because almost to a company, when you look at it, you realize that there are issues that need to be addressed if they wanted to improve the value, even if they were selling it to the family. Mm-hmm. Owners should not leave problems to their kids to try mm-hmm. to solve. Mm-hmm. So there are things that should take place. That issue that I mentioned a moment ago about making the owner obsolete is actually one of the biggest single issues that needs to get addressed. Mm-hmm. Unless the owner is able to play golf 5 days a week without worrying about the business, the business is starting to slip in value. I'm not saying it's not valuable, but mm-hmm. there's a value component that's lacking in that business because it depends on the owner for day-to-day success.
Well, it's a double-edged sword because you want them to start the process as soon as possible because it is such a process.
Right.
And yet the sooner they start, the harder it is to let go because the horizon looks so far out and you want to keep control of that quicker.
It is. It is a control issue for people. Mm-hmm. We feel safe in our businesses. It's a very comfortable thing, especially if it's working reasonably well. And to let other people run it for you is giving up a lot of control.
Yeah.
The perception of
right.
a lot of control.
Right. One of the things our listeners will hear if they go back through our archive is that for most of the owners that were successful, they had another vision past this particular business. So they had their next life figured out, whether it was sailing away or starting another business. Do you find that facilitates that letting go a little bit?
I think that's true of every successful entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. This was only a step in the process.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true indeed.
Do you have any, real life stories, sort of, or basic examples where you can show where something, maybe they didn't do what needed to be done and where the buyout didn't occur as they wanted? Or can you talk or give us examples?
There are a lot of those, actually. That's the unfortunate thing about it. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And in fact, I would tell you that probably 85% of the time when you've done that initial value and triage, the owners don't want to go too much further with it. That's how scary that is to people. And again, many times it's that question of obsolescence, although there can be other issues. So many times owners have a very difficult time about moving that deal further. And there are plenty of cases out there that are just like that. I can think of a government contractor that always had trouble hiring the people that they needed. But actually, I think they were the ones driving the inability to hire those people. And because of that, they were not a very good candidate for a sale, at least not on a strategic basis. And these were strategic buyers.
You mean they should have hired Pat to do the
something exactly. like that. Huh? Well, you know, the funny thing about this is a process and it's a team process. Mm-hmm. Once that triage has been done, it takes a number of influencers and friends of the owner to get the process underway. No one person has enough skill to pull it all off on their own.
And you let's back up a little bit, because you talked about your process in identifying different strategies for different value worlds. So are you lining up where applicable, because not every business necessarily has a strategic buyer, but if there's a strategic buyer, if there's a maybe consideration to family, so multiple potential buyers, are you developing a strategy for each of those outcomes and then executing simultaneously?
No. No, you really don't want to do that, probably. You'd waste too much time. Again, you need to focus attention. If your goal is to sell to the highest possible price, then at least we know what our focus is and what we need to do to try to get there. If I mentioned this earlier, if you want to transition within the family, there's a whole other set of issues that need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Not just that the company needs to operate well, by the way, but the family needs to find the successor and spend years training them. Mm-hmm. Now, that successor doesn't just suddenly come out of college and walk into the boardroom. It doesn't happen that way. So there are a whole different set of issues depending upon who you want to sell it to.
So pick a strategy and execute against that.
Yeah. Now, again, let's talk about entrepreneurs being successful. Every successful entrepreneur I know has a plan B. Mm-hmm. And so while you may have your primary objective, you need to keep the second objective in mind. Mm-hmm. Things happen. Mm-hmm. And a long time ago, a very successful young owner, business owner of a large company. He was a successor, by the way. His father had died. Told me that he always went home and slept okay if he knew how he was going to run the company tomorrow if this didn't work. Mm. Now, again, I learned a lot when I was a young guy out there doing this stuff, listening to that client. That was also the one, by the way, where we were studying the different markets and determining that if we could just stop making this product, we would suddenly make a lot more money. But his attitude was that, and I learned a lot from this, that you always have to have a plan B. And if you can survive plan B, then go for it on plan A.
All right. Oh, great. So, you know, we talked, it's not the bottom line, it is the bottom line, it's cash flow is important.
Yeah, at the end of the day.
So how does an owner increase their cash flow?
Well, a number of things we've touched on a bit. First of all, you don't solve the cash flow problem by reducing expenses. It's kind of an important concept. You know, we listen to General Motors having all of these problems, and they say, well, we're going to slash this and slash that. At the end of the day, companies become better because they have worked on both the top line and the material in the middle. They've decided that they're going to start selling different products to different people, different prices, deliver them differently. So that whole question needs to be looked at. What are we selling? To whom? At what prices? How are we getting it delivered? That's a big component of the question. Cost is another item. I mean, privately held businesses frequently have costs in there that don't belong there. We joke about the planes and the boats. I've seen the vacation homes in there. And many times when you're trying to do a transaction, these things muddy up the water. Mm-hmm. And it's not that people can't work through them, perhaps, but it does add higher risk because of the uncertainty of what I'm really looking at as a buyer. Do I really see what I think I see? And it also raises uncertainty about what that bottom line really is. Mm-hmm. And every one of those reduces value. So clean up the P&L. Don't operate as an incorporated checkbook. Mm-hmm. That is so common in American business.
You know, I have frequently been asked to bring in someone at a COO, VP Ops for a family business that's starting to get ready to sell in manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And one of the top criteria has been supply chain expertise. And a lot of these businesses are manufacturing. So when you're talking about reducing costs, am I right that they tend not to have looked at the supply chain and pull costs out of that, which can really add.
It is. It's one of those issues that you need to take a look at. You're right, especially if you've been doing one type of process for a long time. It's not that you get lazy about it, but you get accustomed to operating a certain way, and you don't realize that you could squeeze some dollars if you were just a little bit smarter about how and when you bought stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And your vendors tend to be used to it, just that they just haven't been asked to help you get it done.
Right. Well, that's one of the opportunities of bringing in a third party who can all of a sudden negotiate and take you out of the picture, because sometimes that vendor relationship is so close that you don't feel like going back and taking out of Rob's pocket because you had Christmas dinner with him.
That's right. It's actually true. And actually, it's one of the reasons why getting somebody on the third party involved always helps, because they bring in some fresh meat in terms of concepts and knowledge. And if you need to negotiate those very difficult party situations, you can do that. And it's easier for them to do it than the owners. In fact, the owners can use it as a great excuse not to have to deal with it.
Exactly.
Mark, you talked about risk reduction, and you mentioned transparency. What are some clear-cut things that family businesses can do to create that transparency for a potential sale?
Put a business plan in place and start working toward it. Create a second level of management, or at least try to make yourself as obsolete as you can. It's harder to do in a very small business than larger ones. But you need to separate the success of the company from you yourself. That's really important. We talked about the business plan, cleaning up the company. Litigation's a big issue. Many companies have litigation laying around. Sometimes they're just in litigious types of businesses, but whenever you have litigation around, that too tends to make it less transparent, more risky. Try to eliminate that as well.
Also, you had talked about ESOPs. Can you explain to our audience what an ESOP is, how it works, that kind of thing?
An ESOP is an employee benefit plan that actually owns the stock of the company or the equity of the company. And it doesn't have to own 100% of it. An owner might decide to sell a portion of the company to the ESOP. What's kind of beneficial from a number of points of view is that with the employees owning it, they get to benefit from the enhanced value of the company. The presumption is that that's going to make employees more dedicated to the company and trying to improve performance all around. There are there's a two-edged sword with ESOPs. On the one side, the owner of the company sells the stock to the ESOP using fair market value, which is one of the lowest values, as we mentioned before. The other side, though, is that the owner got or can get tremendous tax benefits from the sale of the stock. They actually can defer the tax in many cases by acquiring certain other types of securities, which many people end up buying anyway. So there's a way to defer the tax effect on it as well. And I don't want to dwell on it too much, but an ESOP or a corporation could elect to be an S corporation. That your listeners may know about that. That's a corporation where the income is passed through to the owners. And since an employee benefit plan is a non-taxable entity, in essence, the company could start operating without having to pay any income taxes. And who knows how long that's going to last with all of the pressures on the purse today, but it is one of the interesting attributes that I look at because taxes account for 40% of a company's output. And if you can save 40% and reinvest it in growth of the company, you can dramatically improve the outcomes.
So for people, ESOP, just so you know, it's in just confirm it's Employee Stock Ownership Program. It's our Sesame Street acronym of the day.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, apparently. Just want to clarify because we start talking in lingo. Now, actually, Ray Pagano had spoken about this. What's been your experience when especially you have middle management rank and file when they own part of the company? I mean, are you seeing in cases that you've seen where that's truly incentivized those employees? Do they get it? I know Ray had a very specific way where he was consistently meeting and reminding these people what it did, but what has been your experience with ESOPs?
Well, you know, it's my own philosophy, but I think it is a good thing for key employees to have parts of the company, whether it's through outright stock ownership or through the option to buy stock. You can look at it from different points of view, but I think that incentive to actually be an owner drives people's decisions about what the future of the company is going to be, and which is the whole reason you want to do that. There are some industries, for example, the biotech industry, the pharma industry, and even the e-tech industry, either regularly provide forms of stock ownership to employees or options in order to incentivize them to work their tails off to build products when the company really can't afford to pay you cash in the interim. But the exit is astronomical. So if we all work hard, we're all going to walk away with a great nest egg at the end of the day. So I think that at least some form of employee ownership, at least at the higher levels, is good. And if you want to do it across the board, the ESOP starts to make a lot of sense if you're a large enough entity to do that with.
There's another aspect to ESOP. Not only does it get the employee really engaged in the business, but it also helps the owner be little less engaged, which is such a critical component.
Actually, you know, that's exactly right. We were talking about obsolescence.
Right.
If you're going to have a good ESOP, you probably need about 100 to 150 employees, so you're dealing with a slightly larger entity, and you have an owner who has already figured out how not to be involved in daily operations. You need a second level of management. And in many cases, to the extent there is financing for those acquisitions, by the way, the lenders are looking for that second management team because they know that they can't count on the owner being around. That's the whole theory of this.
Right.
So, all of that stuff starts to come into play.
Yeah, it forces the issue on both sides.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
You know, we always hear about owners complaining about, you know, to do the deal, we've got to have owner financing. I mean, is this what you're seeing out there, or do you think it's true?
It's rare to find an all-cash deal today. And that's especially true if it's a strategic acquisition, especially if the strategic value is a stretch. The buyer is always going to take the position that there's high risk in that strategic, that incremental value, and therefore, that's going to be largely leveraged, And there will be a clawback involved in it, where if we don't hit the outcomes that we're after, the seller takes a bit of it back. But even in the average mom-and-pa business sold today, seller financing of anywhere from 15 to 50% is just not unheard of today, primarily because finding the capital to do these transactions is difficult from the normal processes we used to use 5 years ago.
Hmm. What do the financial markets look like out there right now? I mean, you've alluded to it being a little bit tighter, and you mentioned some of the non-traditional sources. So are you seeing that? So private equity is a common route, essentially?
Sometimes it is. Private equity groups, they're part of that bunch of people I was telling you about that has so much cash around, and they need to do something with it. Many times, if they can't find the companies to buy fast enough, they're willing to lend money on 3 to 5 year notes, enough to get us through what we hope is through this recession. Let's hope that 3 to 5 years does that. So there's a market there. There are also a lot of literally private individuals who have started their own funds for private lending. I don't want to overlook a couple of other sources that are out there. There are banks that still loan money. I just saw an article today in the Wall Street Journal. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal where the Bank of America was advertising how much money it has lent this year. I don't know how much of that was loan renewals mm-hmm. versus incremental cash. And that is a source for larger companies, I think, in many cases. But smaller transactions, under $5 million, the SBA is a great source for that money, and it means using a bank, usually a local bank. I mean, mm-hmm. usually is what happens. The problem with a lot of banks is not that they don't want to lend you money, but they're not capable of loaning money anymore. Mm-hmm. They are so stretched from an equity point of view, they don't have the ability to loan fresh money. They can do it through the SBA guarantee program. It's a fairly complicated program. A lot of dots need to be, or a lot of I's need to be dotted, T's crossed. A lot of it, by the way, are such strange things as having a business plan in place. So just keep in mind that a lot of it is forcing people to do what they should be doing anyway. Right. But that's a source to use. The U.S. Department of Agriculture also has a program that I think goes up to $25 million. And I'm going to tell you that these are the rules as I recall them. They will lend not just to farms. There was a time that's what they were created for, actually, but they loan to anything that they believe can create value within the community, jobs primarily. And they're a great group of people to deal with, and they don't have some of the constraints that you have with SBA financing. Mm. And as I say, they go up to $25 million. So we encourage people to look at that type of a transaction as well.
I'm going to extrapolate something from all of this conversation that strikes me and ask you your thoughts on this. So there is some cash out there. There's some other lenders, third-party lenders, sellers. At the end of the day, regardless of what the economic situation is out there, what I'm kind of hearing is if you build your business right, if you look ahead and say, somewhere down the line I need an exit strategy, so I'm going to have a business plan in place, I'm going to make sure I make myself obsolete, I'm going to get my employees engaged, and I'm going to build a business that has good cash flow, that has taken risk out, and I position myself, regardless of whether we're in 2010, and you know we saw Ray sold in 2009, a good business well run will have a buyer when they're ready to sell. Is that pretty accurate?
That is accurate. That mm-hmm. is actually the truth right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of buyers looking for good businesses to buy right now. I think the bigger problem is so many owners of businesses, it's almost a deer in the headlights attitude right now that I don't know what to do, so I'm just not going to do anything right now. Mm-hmm. I'm uncertain about it. Well, this is actually a great time to turn that around and mm-hmm. take control of it. This is a great time to plan an exit. You've got time to do it. The economy is forcing you to run the business better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to enhance the outcome.
Yeah.
Mark, so we have the owner out there that's listening right now, and they need to look at beginning this process right now to go ahead and sell their business. Do they need to get evaluation done first? Let's assume they have their business plan. They've been grooming their successor. What's the next step to do the deal?
Well, and again, this may be maybe personal to me. I'm sure other people would have other thoughts. My position on this is figure out what the company is worth to different types of people. That way you can start focusing attention on who you're going to sell this to. And once you've done that, figure out what you need to enhance the value. And I say enhance value, that really is to improve the operations, make it a saleable business. Enhance that value as much as you can by doing all of the things that we've talked about before, starting with obsolescence, make yourself obsolete, dealing with all the things we can do to improve cash flow and reduce risk. That's really what you need to do. But I like to start with the question of what is this really worth to different people and what can I do to make it better? And literally, when I say that, what is the action plan? What is the potential action plan to make it better?
And then how do we execute?
And how do you execute?
And talk about, again, we'll refer back to this trusted advisor group. What's the team look like that I should be thinking about assembling for this process?
You need a good CPA. And again, by the way, these might not be your regular people, but you need a CPA. You need an attorney. You need a financial manager. One of the things that I think gets overlooked is that your personal affairs need to be managed well, too, at the same time. And what you're going to do with your funds when you do sell it is really pretty important. That gets overlooked a lot. Not just here, by the way, but there are other areas where sudden life events occur where people suddenly have cash they never had before, and they haven't talked to people to try to figure out how to manage that. So that's a big issue. Other than that, depending upon the needs of the business, there are a whole host of things that might come up. You may need engineers in the manufacturing side. You may need coaches. Some owners need a lot of coaching. Mm-hmm. There's possibly a need for a psychologist or psychiatrist actually in there, especially if it's a family transaction. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that we can bring to the table up front in that triage is try to identify where the potential issues are and where the support is that is going to be needed. And sometimes it's not the owner's best friends in there. You know, I hate to say this, but fresh blood sometimes helps a lot to move a process along quickly.
They're not afraid to say the things that need to be said.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of couth myself, actually, when it comes to that. But I think that's kind of important. When somebody wants to get something done, the right news is perhaps more important than the easy answer.
And you said not your regular people. So really what you're saying is get a transaction attorney, get a deal, people that are involved in deals.
Might be. Mm-hmm. And again, if you're in certain fields, like if you're in manufacturing, I don't know about you, but I'm not a manufacturing expert. I can tell you where it hurts at 32,000 feet, but somebody else has got to do those fixes. Mm-hmm. And supply chain issues, that's not my expertise. I can see it, but I'm not the person to deal with it. So one of the things that we do is we know a lot of people who have those skill bases so that when we need them, we can recommend that certain people draw it in to help get the job done.
That's great.
That's great.
You know, we've covered a lot. We really have done a great job. I think, thank you, Mark, for covering the whole gamut. But we always like to leave our guests with three really great tips that they can turn to so that they can get a quick summary of this. And if they're ready to sell, they can run to these tips and have the information they need. Can you share some tips for us?
Well, I'm limited to three. Is that it? All right. Here's what I would do. The first thing is plan the exit. If you own a business, you need to figure out how to get out of it. So sit down and figure that out quickly. Talk to friends, influencers, advisors about what that means and get that plan in place. It should be part of your daily business plan. Make yourself obsolete. That has to be a big thing on the list, and it's true of almost every entrepreneur. You need to figure out how to get somebody else involved in that business who could run it in your absence. If you don't do that, you're limiting the value of the business right off the top. By the way, you're also limiting the skill base in the business. You're going to learn a lot of new tricks from a second level of management. Do whatever you need to do with that new team to add cash flow and reduce risk. You got to make it more profitable, and you got to make it look right. So get a plan up front, make yourself obsolete, and focus on increasing cash flow and reducing risk.
That's great, Mark. No, we really appreciate that today. I think you actually brought a lot of topics that we've talked about in previous shows and kind of tied a lot of them together.
Yeah, that's great.
Good. Well, I'm glad.
And for our listeners, you'll be able to see a summary of this presentation on our website, and you will be able to download the podcast that will be up on our site next week. And when I refer to our site, I mean that you should go to www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com, and you will see this and many of our other presentations. And Mark, if you piqued somebody's interest today and they'd like to get in touch with you for additional questions or help, how do they reach you?
Two ways. A good way, obviously, is to give me a telephone call, and my cell phone is a good number because I'm often on the move. That cell is 678-662-6478. You can email me at mdayman, D-A-Y-M-A-N, at capval, C-A-P-V-A-L, -LLC.com.
And our listeners, you'll find those links to his phone and to his email and to his company on our website as well, so that you can refer to those. Thank you.